Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. A modern cargo ship is one of the largest things you're likely to ever see move. You're talking about a vessel that requires an engine with 80 or 100,000 horsepower. Assisted by tugboats and specialized pilots, these massive ships navigate crowded waters filled with little boats and, of course, human infrastructure, like Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, which collapsed after a container ship hit it last week. We asked today, could that happen here? What processes and precautions are in place to prevent such a disaster at the Golden Gate or anywhere else in the Bay? That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. The maritime world that we're going to dive into today is complex and, to be honest, a little hived off from most other parts of our society. Some years ago, I made a podcast about this maritime world in the Bay called Containers, and I was astonished to discover the intricate ecosystem that's responsible for moving goods and fossil fuels and cars from the world to our home here. Today, with the Baltimore accident fresh in our minds, we want to focus specifically on the safety of our waterways. The people in the maritime world have a ton of specialized knowledge and training, and we want to work through some of the basics together so we can understand our particular safety issues here in the region. Joining us to discuss, we've got Scott Humphrey, Executive Director of the Marine Exchange San Francisco Bay Area and the Chairman of the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee. Welcome, Scott.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good morning, Alexis.
We're also joined by Captain Taylor Lamb, Captain of the Port for Northern California for the U.S. Coast Guard. Welcome, Captain.
Good morning, Alexis. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. So, Scott, as Executive Director of the Marine Exchange, your team tracks every ship that comes into the Bay Area. Can you kind of paint me a picture? Like, what are our big ports for people who don't know in this region? And kind of where are they moving through the Bay?
That's a really good question. And it's not always an easy question to ask, to answer, because we have five designated ports. The Port of Redwood City. Now, watch me not be able to list them all. The Port of Oakland, the Port of San Francisco, the Port of Richmond, the Port of Benicia. Actually, I did miss the number. The Port of Stockton and West Sacramento. Forgive me if I've left you out. But we also have dozens of marine terminals between those ports, oil refineries, Crockett Sugar, for example, and in an infinite number of places tugs, barges, and ferries can go. The majority of shipping goes into the Port of Oakland, if you look at it, I guess, per capita, container ships. But some of the most important transits in our region go the furthest distance to the ports of West Sacramento and Stockton.
Mm-hmm. Which means going all the way up, you know, into the Delta, not just across open bay waters, but kind of what's through sort of a river.
Yes, I like to say that the San Francisco Bay region is almost akin to the ultimate driver's ed test. I think Alameda Park Street is probably the best example for a car where just about everything can happen. A ship coming in from sea comes in from the open ocean across a narrow dredged bar through a rock bottom bay. The San Francisco Central Bay has to navigate very precisely around these hazards. If it turns to the left, it goes up through the San Pablo Bay, a mud bottom bay that's crisscrossed by two earthquake faults that really cut right across the narrow channel, under a plethora of bridges through the Sassoon Bay, and then up into what looks like, in my opinion, in sort of the bayous of Louisiana, flat land with beautiful mountains in the distance. That'd be the difference. And very narrow rivers and passages. And most people probably don't know that there is a 50-mile long canal carved between roughly Rio Vista and the port of West Sacramento that ships take to bring cargo into that port.
So interesting. And of course, all the ports have their own different specialties. You know, in San Francisco, we get cruise ships, and Port of Oakland, you know, it's mostly the containers that you can see the cranes for, you know, and we have these fuel depots that exist along things. When we're talking about how, let's just do like a very typical ship. Let's like, you know, it's some ship that's coming from a manufacturing region of Asia and it's going to the port of Oakland. It's filled with containers. What happens in that case? Like, does the, like, who actually pilots in that ship into the port of Oakland?
One of roughly 60 women or men from the San Francisco Bar pilots, which I'm really glad you asked that question. We don't have anyone from the pilots here today, but I cannot say enough about the work that the
pilots... We did try to get them.
Oh, well, then let me speak for them in this case, just to say that they are probably the most well-trained and most expert in any field. With respect to navigation, these pilots board the ship 12 miles out at sea at what we call the San Francisco Sea Buoy. They climb up the side of a ship in heavy seas, so their day starts with what most of us might consider to be a crisis, having to jump from one boat to another in heavy seas. They board a ship that... They may or may not have ever even been aboard before with a crew that they probably have never met, certainly not seen in a while. And they pilot these ships through the Golden Gate, through the Central Bay. If the ship is going into Oakland, then it's probably going to go through what we call the deep water traffic lane. That's a designated route with a very concerning underwater rock just to the south of it. So they very meticulously navigate the ship around this rock. They turn down through the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge and navigate into the Oakland Outer Harbor. Mm-hmm. And I use that as an example because if you've watched any of the YouTube videos of the giant 747s coming in with a lot of crosswind, you've probably seen the sort of a crabbing effect as the plane is not lined up for the runway, the bow, the pointy end of the plane is pointing off the heading. You actually see that happening in the Port of Oakland with a strong current as the ship is approaching the port.
Yeah. It is. It's a remarkable thing to navigate these enormous vessels that are so heavy and that require so much. Of course, they're also sometimes aided. I think they all the ships coming into the Port of Oakland are aided by tugboats, too, right, who are sort of choreographed by the bar pilot, but also have their own captains who are running those ships too.
That's correct. The tugboats for a ship that's coming into the Port of Oakland usually join the ship at just south of the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge. And then the pilot, I won't say takes control of the tugs, but the pilot starts, as you described, choreographing the behavior of the tugs.
Captain Lamb, talk to me a little bit about your responsibility as the captain of the port for Northern California. What's that actually entail when it comes to this kind of shipping world?
Yes, absolutely. Great question. So as captain of the port, I am responsible for overseeing maritime safety and security for commercial ships that are operating in the bay or along the coast as they conduct their transits, as well as a commercial waterfront operations. In addition to that, another federal hat that I wear statutorily is that as the officer in charge of marine inspections. So as you might imagine, a lot of our Coast Guard marine inspectors will be on board these large deep draft vessels that are either U.S. flagged or foreign flagged to ensure that they're safely operating and that they are safely manned.
So just to kind of pull out some of the implications of what you're saying, inspections are important, right, because we need ships functioning properly so that they don't, for example, lose propulsion or steering.
Absolutely. And we can go deeper if you like, but, you know, we have a regulatory framework by which our marine inspectors will get on board these vessels and conduct assessments. There's a couple different terms of art, certificate of compliance, which is something that vessels typically will require every 2 years to make sure that they are operating safely in accordance with International Maritime Organization and safety of life at sea regulations. As it relates to foreign flag vessels, we do what are called port state control examinations, and these are required anytime a foreign flag ship is visiting a U.S. port for their first time or as required based on a holistic assessment of that ship's history.
So how often do you end up holding up a ship and saying, like, you know, we're not sure that this ship is functioning properly?
That's a great question. I will tell you that it's generally rare. And when you consider the fact that we do about 1,000 inspections of both U.S. and foreign flag vessels per year, It really is generally a small fraction of that, where there are such significant safety discrepancies or safe manning operation concerns that would lead me as a captain of port to detain a vessel in port. It does happen, but it's generally very rare.
So, Captain, what are your like crucial safety considerations? Like, what are the things that you worry about when it comes to the safety of our waterways?
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple of different aspects to this. Obviously, as you know, the Coast Guard is responsible for search and rescue. And so that is one of the other federal statutory hats that I wear, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So from a safety of life, a standpoint, that is always our first and foremost concern. As it relates to ships safely operating in the bay or near the bay, a big concern, obviously, is the environmental protection of our sensitive ecosystems and national marine sanctuaries. And then clearly from a safe navigational standpoint, which obviously directs our global supply chain, as well as other homeland and national security equities, those are all very front and center for me in terms of concerns.
But like specifically around navigational safety then, are you worried more about ships losing power, ships running into each other, big ships hitting small ships, hitting a bridge? You know, what are the different concerns that you might have there?
Oh, absolutely. And so as Scott knows very well, you know, there is always inherent risk when conducting operations in the maritime domain, despite our collective efforts to mitigate those risks. But as you say, there is always the potential risk or hazard of a vessel running aground or colliding with another vessel or alighting with a fixed structure. And obviously those bring into the concerns that I noted earlier. So those are certainly concerns, especially when you talk about some of the narrow waterways that come from the San Francisco Sea Buoy all the way up to places like Stockton and Sacramento for sure.
You know, when we think about a bridge like the Golden Gate, which of course every ship that's passing in the bay has to go under, what kind of protections are in place there on the bridge itself, or are most of the protections in the system around the bridge?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I can't speak very articulately on the actual construction and physical structures around the bridge for protection. I know there are a variety of
You're more focused on not hitting it.
That's correct. Absolutely. What I can speak, though, to is the intricate coordination and communication that occurs very frequently, in fact, on a daily basis throughout the day, every hour, between the Coast Guard Sector San Francisco Vessel Traffic Service, the San Francisco Marine Exchange, our bar pilots, tugboat captains, and others, to ensure that people understand the weather conditions at the time, and they certainly understand the forecast of that weather to deconflict any potential hazards that might occur between vessels.
Yeah. We're talking about Bay Area waterways and maritime safety with Captain Taylor Lamb, Captain of the Port for Northern California for the U.S. Coast Guard, as well as Scott Humphrey, Executive Director for the Marine Exchange SF Bay Area and the Chairman of the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee. What questions do you have about this maritime world and its safety, especially with what happened in Baltimore, fresh in our minds? You can give us a call. The number's 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can find us on any of our social channels or our digital community on Discord. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about maritime safety here in our Bay Area waters. We're joined by Scott Humphrey, Executive Director for the Marine Exchange SF Bay Area and the Chairman of the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee. We're also joined by Captain Taylor Lamb, Captain of the Port for Northern California for the U.S. Coast Guard. I wanted to ask you, Scott Humphrey, talk to me a little bit about what would happen if we had a situation like happened with this Dolly cargo ship in Baltimore, where a ship does lose power and propulsion and is moving towards one of the bridges in the Bay Area.
Okay, I can speak to a generic scenario or perhaps even more specific scenario. Back in March of 1985, it was covered rather heavily in the media. A ship called the Mondogas Europe lost steering and propulsion just outside the Golden Gate Bridge. They were coming in, going upriver to Sacramento, I believe it was. And the pilot on board the ship I would say heroically, managed to stop that ship several hundred yards from the bridge in the vicinity of Baker Beach. So what happened in that case was the pilot immediately, first, just like flying a plane, the first goal is to fly the plane. So the pilot has to make sure that they're in control of the ship as much as they can. He dropped the anchors on the ship and I would say simultaneously called the vessel traffic service on the radio and said, we have lost steering and propulsion. We're taking, we've dropped our anchors. Immediately, the vessel traffic service then calls out for tugboats in the area. The call goes out to any tug and all tugs that are available come rushing toward the ship. In the meantime, the vessel traffic service is communicating with the sector command center, which is the Coast Guard office directly next door to the VTS, getting them prepared for what could turn out to be a search and rescue or a emergency response of some type. Yeah. In the meantime, the tugs are racing toward the ship and the pilot is doing what they can to keep control of the ship.
Yeah. Captain Lamb, do you want to... add anything to sort of what we would see if, you know, that was in 1985. What might be different now? Are there any different regulations? Would it matter what type of ship it was?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would just focus really on the incident response. And so as Scott spoke on artfully just a few moments ago, you know, in addition to emergency tug assistance, I would guarantee you that the Coast Guard would be putting out emergency broadcasts for folks, mariners in the area to be aware that there may be an emergency situation occurring. I can tell you that we would be launching a variety of different Coast Guard and emergency first responder assets. And certainly we would be looking to move towards what's called an incident command system structure or incident command, if you will. And that really is a powerful entity comprised of a number of local, state, federal industry partners that would be charged with leveraging all the resources and authorities possible to save lives, to protect the environment, and to ensure a safety of those within the water.
Yeah. I want to add another voice into our discussion. Tony Munoz is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Maritime Executive. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and enjoying listening to the conversation of the captain and the Marine Exchange, Scott at the Marine Exchange. Well done, guys.
Thanks, Tony. You know, one of the interesting things is you've had a chance to talk with some people in Baltimore, I know, and then you wrote a, I guess I would call it an op-ed, basically saying that there was something that could have prevented this accident from happening in Baltimore, and that would have been tug escorts. Talk to us a little bit about kind of how you arrived at that through your kind of industry experience.
I was in San Francisco when the Open 90 was being enforced by the state of California.
This is regulations that require tugs for tankers, right?
That's correct. And the state of California, there wasn't an argument about whether they were going to do it or not. They were doing it. And it was a matter of what type of tug was the issue at hand. But their nightmare was certainly an oil tanker hitting a bridge. Mm. And I think throughout the industry, we all, port captains and the stakeholders, people know what the hazardous zones are in their channel. And they identify them. What happened here was this bridge that was built in the 70s. There was a lot of traffic that went through there. And it was a known hazard. They didn't have numbers on the bridge columns. So a tug should have at least taken it through the bridge and got it and gotten it to so it could go out to sea. And that didn't happen. The tugs took it off the dock, let it, pointed it in the right direction. It and his pilots moved forward. And during that period of time, the engines stopped twice. Yeah. And they put out the Mayday. They were able to stop the traffic on the bridge. They dropped anchor. There was, if you watch the video, there's a little puff of smoke that comes out of the funnel. And that basically means that they were trying to throw that engine into reverse to halt it. And like an automobile, when you go to squeal it, you goose the accelerator, it squirrels a little bit. And in this particular case, it was the same issue that they call it the P factor. And when they threw that into reverse with whatever live engine that they had, it projected it to the right and into the column, taking it from the bridge. So it was pretty nasty for sure. Pretty terrifying overall.
Yeah. You know, Scott Humphrey, you know, immediately after the accident happened, you know, former port commissioner Margaret Gordon got in touch with me and was like, why didn't that ship have tug escort, you know? And what is the reason why we wouldn't just have tug escort on like every big ship? I mean, is, you know, belt and suspenders, right? I mean, if we know that ships lose propulsion sometimes and we have these tugs that could possibly be able to help, like what's the, how should we think about that?
I think a better question is, why do ships lose steering and propulsion? And why is this happening as frequently as it's happening? It's certainly, I think it's worth discussing. I really liked something Mr. Munoz said about the, and I don't know how the bridge in Baltimore was built, but that you look at a specific situation when you're deciding what your risk mitigation measures are. As far as why we don't have tugs escorting container ships, I guess I would say, without sounding snarky, perhaps you don't wrap your kids in bubble wrap before you send them out. It may not be necessary to have a tug escorting every single ship that's going through bridges. Ships should not be having engine failures. If a ship is subject to, historically having engine problems, and maybe the captain of the port can talk to this, I know the captain can order specific criteria for that tug's departure. Would you like to address that, Captain?
Yeah.
Absolutely, I appreciate that. So Scott's absolutely right. So other than the state requirement that tanker ships be escorted via tugs, really it's a case-by-case analysis. We have had cases in the past in the Bay Area where we were informed of a potential propulsion issue. Maybe there was a steering issue that was observed by the master of the vessel and the ship's crew. Well, they are required legally to inform us of that, so our marine inspectors can be prompted to conduct an assessment of that vessel before it's allowed to safely transit in. So there have been instances with that scenario in mind where I have directed, as the captain of port, to have escort tugs until we ensure that we understand the cause of that issue and to ensure that the repairs are done satisfactory to my staff and my team, as well as to the classification society or the flag state, as well as the bar pilots that are charged with safely navigating that ship inbound.
Yeah. You know, Captain, I know you have to go in a sec, so I want to get you one listener question before you go. Bill in San Francisco, go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. This is fascinating. It's a terrible accident that happened, and I really don't want to see it here, so I'm glad you're doing this show. What I haven't really heard a lot about is how often ships lose power like this. And the ships have become so enormously huge and can take out a bridge so easily. And it seems like so many bridges aren't fortified the way they should be. If tugs are the only real breaks, then why is it that tugs aren't, you know, assigned to all ships going through all, you know, ports, you know, the whole time? And if it's important to pull in this emergency response team. I think in Baltimore, there was only 6 minutes or so, you know, from that call to when it hit the bridge. And it just doesn't seem like there's enough time to make, besides the tug that's already there, I don't see what else could happen. Yeah.
Thanks, Bill. Captain Lamb?
Hi, I apologize. I lost connection briefly, but I think the question was that
there are two questions. One is, how often do ships lose power? And then the second sort of part B was, if it's kind of often, why not tugs?
Yes, very good. So I will tell you, it is not. I can't quantify how often we have ships that either have a reduction in propulsion or a loss of propulsion. I will tell you that it does happen from time to time in a given month, in a given week. But as far as the second question, you know, I believe that's really a conversation between state regulators as well as the federal side of the house in terms of whether or not, from a risk management standpoint, that ought to be something that is implemented and taken effect. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really a careful risk assessment weighing the trade-offs on that question.
Thanks, Captain Taylor Lamb, Captain of the Port for Northern California for the U.S. Coast Guard. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, I want to stay on this topic just for a sec. Tony Munoz, after you published your article saying, hey, you know, tug escorts are a good idea, what's the pushback on it? Is basically it kind of slows things down and it's more expensive?
Well, first, you just don't have that many tugs to accommodate every hazard. So you depend on the pilots and the captain of the ship to navigate properly. And 90% of the time, 95% of the time, 99% of the time, they do it. But there is that percentage that is very concerning. San Francisco is an extremely tight port. Baltimore is not. In that particular case, you know, the first call was perhaps it was fuel. They also say that the Coast Guard had been on the vessel earlier in the day to inspect it, and start to inspect every vessel that comes into port. So there was obviously a concern. So that is also being played as an issue. So fuel and perhaps the history of the ship, you know, warranted that conversation. But overall, you had some really good pilots that were managing that vessel through Baltimore. And had they had a tugboat that they could have, they radioed, they put out the mayday, they stopped the traffic, they dropped the anchor, they threw the ship into reverse, they did everything humanly possible to stop that ship. But it hit the bridge. And it took down that bridge in such a horrific way. I've never seen anything like that. And I think that's a major concern. And I think when you look at channels of navigation throughout the world, there are places that are very, very concerned. Example, you have the entrance of the Anacortes waterway in Seattle. They have the Mihai Bay there. There is very tidal. It's very narrow. And they placed a tug there, the Indian reservation population there. They have a tugboat that's there 100% of the time, just in case, as those tankers full of crude come out of St. Prince William Sound into their harbor. And they're very concerned about that. So they have taken the ability that they are concerned about that waterway and place to tug there. There are other places in the world that, and in our country, one of the, I think San Francisco is a very scary place for oil tankers coming in. They at times have to come through the Golden Gate at sea speed. They have tugboats outside the headlands, escorting it in. But you also have some pretty good sized container ships coming into Oakland as well. Most of the time, these tugboats meet it on the bay side, the harbor side of the the Bay Bridge. Could they meet them near Alcatraz and take them under the bridge? You know, that's a little extra time, but it might be a safety factor that needs consideration.
Yeah, Scott, so what is the process for changing one of these safety protocols in the Bay Area? Like, I assume it's not just like you say, like, all right, let's do some tugs here. I assume there's like somebody looks at it and we figure out how to do it.
One of the things I think that makes our area so special, and I've worked in several port areas around the country, is our really tight relationship between the Coast Guard, the Marine Exchange, and our maritime community. We have a very functional, very productive Harbor Safety Committee, and I'm proud to be the chairman of that committee. But what I've got so much to unpack. I've been trying to take notes as quick as I could to try to remember. But one of the things I think we're all saying is that we need a risk assessment. We need something objective. We have what's called a PAWSA. That's a Ports and Waterways Safety Assessment. A PAWSA is something that's done periodically. It's a subjective assessment of waterway safety. We need something more objective. I'm proposing that we do something on a short order called a Simplified IALA Risk Assessment. We can tie that in with some sophisticated software and the data that, for example, the Marine Exchange has, and inside 8 to 10 weeks, we can produce a mathematical risk assessment that will do a lot of what Mr. Munoz is describing specifically to each bridge. It could be that a risk assessment would reveal that extra tugs are needed at a specific location in the bay. But it may not be a bridge. It could be another piece of infrastructure.
So when we talk about what are the factors that would go in there, like it would be, you know, how subject they are to tidal forces, the reinforcements around the bridge piers, like are those the factors?
All of those would be the factors. And since the risk assessment wouldn't be only focused at bridges, but we have tunnels, we have pipes, we have cables, and we have rocks.
You mean the BART tunnel, right?
The BART tunnel, yeah. The BART tunnel goes underneath the Oakland Outer Harbor. That's something that it's a bridge that we don't see, but pilots have to think about every time they bring a ship into the Oakland Outer Harbor. And sort of tangentially, that speaks to the pilot's expertise in doing a risk assessment, because as the pilot is transiting over that tunnel in the Oakland Outer Harbor, he or she has to think, if that ship loses propulsion or steering or something else happens, do I drop the anchor or do I take another type of evasive maneuver? Mm. So pilots are quite often having to choose the better of two worsts in that scenario. The risk assessment would tell us exactly where the risks are, what level of risk we have, but they would also tell us what we could do to mitigate the risk. There is sophisticated anomaly detection systems out there. We have it at the Marine Exchange that can monitor a vessel's movement and detect precise nuances in their behavior that might lead to alerting a vessel as to an impending risk.
So interesting. We're talking about Bay Area Maritime Safety with Scott Humphrey, Executive Director for the Marine Exchange SF Bay Area and the Chairman of the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee, as well as Tony Munoz, Publisher and Editor-in-Chief of the Maritime Executive. We'll be back with more right after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about Bay Area waterways, maritime safety with Tony Munoz, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Maritime Executive, as well as Scott Humphrey, executive director for the Marine Exchange SF Bay Area and the chairman of the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee. For those who don't know, the Marine Exchange is I think it's the oldest business in California, right?
1849.
They've been tracking ships in the Bay Area since maybe before California was a state.
We turned 175 this year, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, one of the oldest institutions around. There's a bunch of people, bunch of listener questions that I want to try and get to here. One is, kind of goes to the training that you were mentioning at the end, Scott Humphrey. Where do people learn how to do these jobs? Maritime academies? In fact, we have a maritime academy right here in the Bay Area. Or is it more on-the-job training?
It's a combination of both. When you say people, are we referring to pilots or
let's call it both. People involved with moving ships in the Bay Area.
Okay. I'm not an expert on the progress, on the system to get there, but I think I can talk to it. We have a local maritime academy, California Maritime Academy, probably one of the best in the country. You go to that academy, you graduate with a third mate's license if you're in a licensing program, and then you hopefully get a job on board a ship as a third mate. You work your way up to chief mate and captain. And if you're interested in pursuing a job as a pilot, you apply for a job with the San Francisco Bar Pilots. And that is probably one of the most intensive training programs anywhere. I spent the last 32 years as the director of training at the Vessel Traffic Service, and I was always absolutely amazed by what they do at the pilots for training. They have a pilot would speak better to this, but they have an extensive training program with on-the-job training that requires that they get certified in various parts of the waterway. Yeah.
I always liked when going up the hawse pipe. I think, right, when you do it out from outside the academy, but just on the job.
And, you know, talking about passenger ferry captains, for example, we need a lot more people in the maritime community right now. We're desperate for workers. One of our board members has a nonprofit called the Bay Area Working Waterfront Coalition to help try to find young people to take these jobs. But that hawsepiper thing you're describing means you start out on the ferry boat as a deckhand. You might be serving cocktails from behind the bar or helping moor the ferry. And you work your way up and hopefully at some point become a captain. Yeah. And a number of our captains today took that route.
Yeah. Let's bring in Peter in San Francisco. Welcome, Peter. Hey, Peter, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I was interested in the costs and the responsibilities for what's going on. It seems to me we have sort of a public waterways and bridges, and then we have private companies making money. And who pays for the safety features, the tugboats, and so on? And how is that determined? Seems to me that another consideration is, have the risks changed? At the time that bridge was built, did there even exist such gigantic and dangerous collision? Ships at all? Did that even exist back in those days? And who bears the cost of the risk, the increased risk? Shouldn't it be the people making the money from having the huge ships?
Peter, what an interesting question. Tony Milish, let's start with you for kind of a national perspective here. In ports around the country, who pays for, I guess, the level of safety, right? There's going to be safety measures in every port, but how does that get determined?
It's a little bit about a ship arriving. It has a lot of costs associated with it. So they, and then insurance companies have transit insurance. There are many different factors to the insurance. For instance, ships going through the Suez Canal or in the Black Sea have war risk, including ships going into the Middle East. The Arabian Sea, you pass through the passage where Iran is. So any ship going in there has to deal with war risk. But ships overall insure themselves. Certainly ports have funding as well. As Scott has mentioned, that they train pilots. To become a pilot, it's not an easy thing to do. To become a master of a ship is more time spent going through training, meeting your IMO regulations, sea time, and it probably takes 20 years to become a ship captain. So they're well educated and they spend a lot of time learning how to operate a ship in different environments. Mm-hmm. They have training simulators that they go to, and they can create all kinds of issues and items. The San Francisco Bay pilots trained at a place called MyTags in Lithicum Heights that had some of the best training simulators in the world. And they would go in there and they would take the Bay Area and put different scenarios together and train the pilots how to bring in the ships accordingly. When a pilot gets on a ship, even though he doesn't take control of the ship, or responsibility for the ship. The master is responsible for that ship coming in and docking properly and leaving the harbor. So the captain is responsible, but the pilots give them guidance because of the local knowledge that they have. So you have some really robust and incredible people navigating these ships in and out of harbors. It's the ship itself. I mean, it could be fuel, it could be mechanical problems, but you do have issues through certain waterways that need to be addressed.
Yeah.
And in my scenario was you need to have the stakeholders assume responsibility for the hazardous areas in their port and comply with tugboats.
Yeah.
And tugboats are an incredible tool in the industry. They're an incredible tool in international trade, and they're probably responsible for the advent of the global economy. You know, before ships had to come in and out on the tide, tugboats changed all that. Tugboats allowed ships to come in anytime. And so it moved a lot more ships through the ports and increased global trade, which I think is pretty incredible. So tugboats are the key to harbor safety. They're the key to international trade. They're the key to the environment, such as what San Francisco has with its 8 bridges. It's a big concern.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate that. You know, for those who are interested, too, in learning more about the sort of training of the ship captains and stuff, there's an amazing John McVie story about a training facility in Revel. And it is just, it's in his book, Uncommon Carriers, for anyone who's interested in that. A couple other, you know, listeners thinking about tug escort. You know, Lewis writes in to say, I sail a small boat on San Francisco Bay. Anytime I'm anywhere where propulsion and steering are essential, I try to have a plan B in case I lose steering or propulsion. It's obvious the ship in Baltimore did not have a plan B. A tug escort would have avoided this catastrophe. Another listener writes, I completely understand that the cost of adding a tug escort to each ship might be daunting, but what about having a tug or two protecting the bridges as large ships move through them? How is it that all bridges spanning a navigational waterway do not have bumpers protecting them? Scott Humphrey, do you want to address any of those things? Like, are those the kinds of measures that could be in play, you know, somewhere in the world or here in the Bay?
I really like that the way that caller or that texter put that. But again, I go back to the risk assessment because nothing is simple when you start digging into it. So imagine a ship in the middle of the San Francisco Bay that now has to have 2 tugs coming toward it. That's 2 more vessels in the waterway that have to get from a place somewhere at a dock, perhaps in Oakland, over to the ship. That adds more. That adds vessels to the waterway. I like the idea, perhaps, of something in the vicinity of a high risk area. But we wouldn't want to do that until we had very carefully measured the risk to benefit. Is the benefit of having those tugs waiting there offsetting the risk of having those tugs have to get there, hold position there? Themselves have to deal with any safety issues that come up. As a recreational boater, I'm sure the caller would agree that a lot more vessels on the bay, which is something we do like to see in maritime, though, does make it more difficult to be a recreational boater. I'd also like to mention that in this Bay Area, we have the highest volume, I believe, anywhere in the country for marine events, which are recreational boating regattas and events, even swimmers.
Yeah, swimmers for sure. You know, when we talk about costs, you know, we had caller Peter in San Francisco who wanted to understand sort of how those costs get apportioned. Like, is there an overall Bay Area safety fund? Or is it that individual ships just have to comply with regulations and so they end up bearing the cost? Or is it individual ports like Oakland or Richmond could subsidize? Or how's that money flow?
Oh, wow. I almost wish I had my colleague here from the Port of Houston, because the Port of Houston has a system that I would really love to adopt here. They have something called the Houston Ship Channel Security District, and it's for port security purposes, but it's essentially an homeowners association, if you will, uh-huh. of dozens, maybe hundreds of organizations, terminals along the waterline that pay into a fund to fund in their case, security. Mm. We could use something like that to fund safety and security. For example, right now, the San Francisco Bar Pilots and Marine Exchange are working to expand our tide and current sensors up into the river and delta region. That's the area, say, east of the Carquinez Bridge. Mm-hmm. We're lacking in sensors there. That's an expensive proposition, $1.5 million, almost $2 million to buy the equipment and $300,000 or so a year to maintain it. There is no funding source for that. A homeowners association, if you will, of all the ports and terminals in the region, chipping in a certain amount of a designated amount of money based on perhaps their size or their revenue or something. I don't know. That's really not my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. But it would provide a pool of money that when you do a risk assessment, first, it could pay for the risk assessment. And second, it could potentially fill in the gaps that might be out there safety-wise until something more permanent could be put into place. Mm.
Something tells me with this Baltimore accident that, you know, some level of legislature is probably going to be looking at some of these things for sure. Yeah. Let's bring in Nick in Menlo Park.
Hey, Alexis. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Go ahead.
Awesome. Thanks so much for doing this program. Huge fan of Forum, and also great to see a light being shed on the maritime community in the Bay Area, and especially bar pilots. My question was just what lessons the Coast Guard and VTS have taken from prior ship collisions with bridges in the Bay Area, for example, the Costco Busan in, I think, 2007 or so, and I think there was maybe an OSG tanker collision with the Bay Bridge another 10 years ago or so, and just what, you know, what changes in policies and regs may have resulted in this incident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hey, Nick, really, really good question. For first, Scott, for those who don't remember what happened, can you give us like a little summary of the incident?
Sure. You're speaking about the Costco Busan.
Yeah, Costco Busan.
The Costco Busan happened in dense fog. The ship had a navigation error, essentially, and navigated toward and into the Bay Bridge Delta Tower. They number their letter the towers mm-hmm. From the island over. And there was a oil spill, I believe, in the neighborhood of 58,000 gallons of oil. If I can answer the question, not from the vantage point of VTS, because I don't work there anymore, although I did for 30 years, mm-hmm. proud to say, but from the Harbor Safety Committee, the outcome of that and the second incident that the caller references, which I believe it was around a year later, was a Harbor Safety Committee best practice, best maritime practice, which you can find on our Marine Exchange website if you're interested in those best practices. But it's not a regulation. It's a non-regulatory solution, but it's something that everyone follows. We developed what are called CMAs, critical maneuvering areas. These are zones around the region where ships should not transit if visibility is X or less. These are voluntary practices, but they can be made mandatory simply by the vessel traffic service stating to the vessel, do not transit. Mm. And they do typically do that. And the pilots, though, you don't have to tell them that because the pilots don't want to transit if it's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Lance writes in to say, you know, quite bothered as it seems, ship owners have decided to build ever larger ships to maximize their profits while at the same time expecting the world's port infrastructure to be rebuilt to accommodate them. Why is there not some governing body to understand the impact to the world's infrastructure and regulate the ship owners? Is it fair to ask Panama to spend multi-billions again to build a third canal system just to accommodate the wants of ship owners? I think it's almost, oftentimes the other way around. The ports are the ones competing for the ships, right? I mean, when you think about the Port of Oakland over the, you know, last 50 years trying to rebuild itself to keep up with, you know, Seattle, Tacoma and LA Long Beach, it's kind of the opposite, right? I mean,
that's the way it would seem. I think it's a balancing act. It's very much being able to move the cargo at a rate, you know, keeping the price good, efficient for moving the cargo, at the same time watching safety. And if you did build a ship too big to go through the Panama Canal, realizing that your ship is going to spend more money on its way from the East Coast to the West Coast.
One shout out for the Harbor Safety Committee and one quick question for you, Scott. Mary writes, another potential risk from shipping traffic is the increased presence of endangered whales in San Francisco Bay and its entrance. Endangered species listed humpbacks from Central America and Mexico are navigating the pinch point of the mile-wide Golden Gate Strait, through which there are roughly 9,000 large ship transits annually. I think Mary knows a little something about this. Yep. Since these humpbacks rarely recognize the threat of an oncoming ship, it's fortunate that a marine mammal work group has been created within the Harbor Safety Committee to minimize threats to whales from ship strike. She calls it a great partnership between conservation and commerce. Another listener writes in to say, are the existing tugboats powerful enough to divert a mega container ship from a collision? Scott?
To the first statement, thank you so much for recognizing that aspect of the Harbor Safety Committee. And I have to shout out, I hope she doesn't mind me saying her name, Kathy George is the chairperson of our marine mammal subcommittee on the Harbor Safety Committee, and she's doing amazing work. As for the power of tugs or their ability to control ships, I can only speak to tank ships because there have been studies done, the Glosson study, I believe is what it's called, back in the 90s, that designed a system for measuring the power of tugs and their ability to control a ship. In fact, that's the data that we use today to designate which tugs are able to escort which tankers. There has to be a certain amount of power. Anecdotally, I could say that if any tug was able to control a fully loaded tanker, it could probably also help a fully loaded container ship. But if it came to the point where tugs were required for container ships, that study or another study would have to be done to make sure that the power was right for the job.
Fascinating. You know, as a listener writes, as a recreational sailor, it's so great to get a crow's nest view of commercial ship navigation in our waters. Comforting to hear from members of this amazing team. We've been talking about Bay Area maritime safety. Been joined by Tony Munoz, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Maritime Executive. Thank you so much, Tony.
You bet. My pleasure and great conversation.
Appreciate it. Earlier, we talked with Captain Taylor Lamb, captain of the port for Northern California for the U.S. Coast Guard. We've also been joined by Scott Humphrey, executive director for the Marine Exchange SF Bay Area and the chairman of the San Francisco Harbor Safety Committee. Thanks so much for joining us, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Thank you so much for all your comments and questions. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.